2023 was the hottest year on record. We're on track for nearly 3 degrees of warming this century. Australia is one of the world's largest exporters of coal, and I see the coal that comes out of Newcastle on a day-to-day basis. And it was just so important to stop that happening.
Welcome to the People's Blockade of the world's largest coal port!
Yes, that's the audio from a teaser to the movie The First Wave. The movie tells the story of what happened at the 2023 People's Blockade, The First Wave, in Newcastle. Yes, welcome. This is the latest episode of Climate Conversations. It's so great to have you on board. I am your host, Robert McLean. This podcast is assembled here in Shepparton, in Northern Victoria, Australia, on the lands of the Yorta Yorta people. Yes, the stolen lands of the Yorta Yorta people. I pay my respects to their elders, past, present and emerging. The movie will be shown at Patagonia at 287 289 Little Collins Street, Melbourne, on Tuesday, April 30, from 6:30 p.m. through to 8 o'clock. Rising Tides say, revisit the epic People's Blockade of Newcastle Coalport with footage from the beach, the water and the sky, and hear from Rising Tide organisers and blockaders about how this historic event came together. After the film, we'll hear from local Victorians who travelled to Newcastle for last year's blockade, who can answer your questions about getting involved in 2024. Stick around afterwards, they say, for snacks and to chat with other people who are part of this growing movement. Don't forget that, Patagonia, Tuesday, April 30, 6:30 p.m. You'll find a link to the Rising Tide website in the show notes. Join me now as we listen to a YouTube clip, Does Every Little Thing Really Stop Climate Change? Recycling, planting trees and going vegan are just a handful of many ways to reduce our carbon footprint. Companies and countries do it too, performing small individual tasks anywhere at any time to save the planet. But these small actions have little impact when compared to the vast polluting and emissions-intensive systems that underpin modern society. In this episode, Dr. Ray Wynn Grant explores how making individuals fully responsible for reducing emissions can be counterproductive to combat climate change.
A lot of us are worried about how our everyday actions affect the planet. With a cursory internet search, we find all sorts of ways to reduce our impact. Recycle, go vegan, switch out a light bulb, or drive an electric car, if you can afford it. Companies do it too. They build LEED certified buildings, install solar panels on the roof, or enroll in carbon offset programs.
Powered by wind and solar,
we're lowering the carbon emissions intensity.
We aim to be net zero across all
for generations to come.
Let's call this the do anything approach. The idea that if everyone takes these small steps anywhere at any time, it'll add up to healthier environments. But here's the problem. These small changes don't add up to stop climate change or biodiversity loss, air pollution, or any of the environmental crises we face. If anything, the do anything approach distracts us from the bigger changes that we actually need to make. The average person in the US emits about 16 tons of carbon per year, mostly through driving, household energy use, and food consumption. Compared to the total global emissions, which are about 36 billion tons of carbon a year, our individual contribution is barely a fraction of a fraction of a percent. Now, not everyone emits equally.
The richest 1% of the global population accounts for more than twice the combined emissions of the poorest 50%.
The wealthiest folks emit way above the average, while people with lower incomes emit less. You can make big changes in your life, like installing solar panels to go off the grid, but that's still a tiny, tiny percent of reduced global emissions. And let's not forget, The vast majority of us don't really have other options other than to drive a gas-guzzling car to work or buy food grown with chemicals and shipped from far away.
The food system is responsible for 20 to 30% of global greenhouse gas emissions.
There's a reason small individual lifestyle changes don't have an impact. A single person going about their day has little control over the high emission systems they rely on. These are complex systems, which include where our energy comes from, the options available for getting to work, agriculture and land use, industrial operations, transportation of goods, and construction.
Our individual footprint is actually quite small compared to the structure of society and the decisions that, for example, fossil fuel companies make, which have 10,000 times more impact than us as individuals.
If the changes we need to make are so big, then why do we default to the do-anything approach?
Food can be grown close to home, reducing the family's carbon footprint.
If everyone carpooled just one day a week, we could reduce our carbon footprint.
Could reduce your dietary carbon footprint.
Reduce your carbon footprint. Turn off those unused lights.
Why do we place so much attention on small, individual, and convenient actions anywhere, at any time, to combat climate change and reduce our impact on environments? For one, it's easier. It doesn't require us to challenge our energy infrastructure, where our reliance on fossil fuels accounts for two-thirds of carbon emissions, or to question how our economy works by encouraging endless pollution to maximize profits.
Exxon intends to increase oil production in Texas and New Mexico.
Chevron will be doing that as the year goes on. We need to drive up supplies.
For the wealthiest among us, who use the most energy and also benefit the most from the economy, saying, "I'll just build an energy-efficient house," allows them to care about the climate crisis. But they don't have to question how they benefit from polluting processes to generate wealth and how they invest their money. Same goes for companies. With the do-anything approach, the largest polluters get to claim they've contributed to climate initiatives while maintaining business as usual. For example, from 2008 to 2018, Exxon invested $250 million to develop technologies that use algae to generate clean biofuels.
That could one day power planes, propel ships, and fuel trucks.
That's doing something. But meanwhile, during the same period, they actually spent about $100 million a day to find and develop new sources of oil and natural gas. They spent about $42 million annually to lobby against climate initiatives.
Did we aggressively fight against some of the science? Yes. We were looking out for our investments. We were looking out for our shareholders. There's nothing illegal about that.
And with several other fossil fuel giants, they spent $175 million annually to market themselves as climate heroes.
It's one of the ways ExxonMobil is advancing climate solutions.
The do-anything approach favors the politically convenient changes that keep the economy working the same way it always has.
Kindly take your seats. We would like to begin. Thank you.
At United Nations climate conferences since the mid-90s, countries negotiate global agreements to address climate change.
The United States fully intends to be the world's preeminent leader in protecting the global environment.
The human consequences of failing to act are unthinkable.
The climate keeps changing faster than our efforts to address it.
It's simple. Will we act?
This is the moment of truth for our planet.
Nations form coalitions to phase out coal and fund forest conservation. They celebrate their non-binding, nationally determined contributions to reduce global emissions.
We'll recommend the adoption of this protocol to the conference by unanimity.
I am very pleased that the United States has reached a truly historic agreement.
I hereby confirm the adoption of the Paris Climate Agreement.
But these reductions fall dramatically short. They don't meet the goal that scientists have established to reach net zero emissions by 2050 to keep global temperatures from increasing above 1.5 degrees Celsius.
The difference between 1.5 and 2.4 is really survival of millions and millions of people and species in the planet.
The most recent commitments put us on track to temperature increases of 2.4 degrees Celsius or even more. That's if UN countries actually meet their commitments, which, so far, they've failed to do.
But did the Glasgow conference do anything to limit the rise in temperatures? China and India not allowing coal to be phased out, only to be phased down. And the final wording on coal has left disappointment.
The do something anywhere at any time approach allows countries and companies that produce the highest greenhouse gas emissions to fail to do anything effective, all while making you believe that you are the problem and you are the solution. It tells us that we can change the light bulbs and buy energy-efficient cars instead of making widespread policy changes.
On this vote, the bill as amended is passed.
So what do we need to do? We need to understand that we can't save the planet through our personal choices day to day. But we can change where our energy comes from.
Hayward is the largest Bay Area jurisdiction to choose fully carbon-free electricity.
How products are made and who can access sustainable ones.
The city today unveiled its first ever all-electric bus. The city plans to eventually switch out its buses with electric buses.
That way, everyone's emissions go down regardless of individual choices. We can change how we all change our environments.
You'll find links to that PBS YouTube event in the show notes. AP has the headline story, verdict saying Switzerland violated rights by failing on climate action could ripple across Europe. Let's listen to the audio from that story now, and you'll find a link for the story in the show notes.
A group of Swiss seniors is celebrating today after Europe's Human Rights Court sided with their argument that Switzerland's government must do more to protect people from the consequences of climate change. The ruling from the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg, France, marks the first time an international court has ruled on climate change and confirmed that countries have an obligation to protect people from its effects. The European Court says Switzerland failed to comply with its duties to fight climate change and meet targets of keeping down emissions of greenhouse gases. The basic gist of the court ruling was that the women's rights to effective protection from the adverse effects of climate change were violated under the terms of a European Convention on Human Rights. The women, average age 74, argued that they were particularly vulnerable to the effects of climate conditions like extreme heat. The verdict comes the same day that the European Union Climate Agency, Copernicus, reported that last month was the hottest March ever on Earth, the 10th straight record month of high temperatures. The government here in Switzerland says it's going to study the decision to see what steps are needed, but recognizes the need to implement it.
Now we have a story from Oil Change. It's about the Permian climate bomb. It has the headline, America's latest fracking boom will bust the climate and intensify environmental injustice from New Mexico to the Gulf Coast. Let's listen to the audio now.
In the past decade, the Permian Basin emerged as the world's single most prolific oil and gas field. Located in West Texas and southeast New Mexico, the basin was producing as much oil in early 2020 as Iraq, over 6 million barrels per day. Only Russia and Saudi Arabia produce more oil on a daily basis. In the decade ahead, as the world grapples with the impacts of COVID-19 while tackling the mounting climate crisis, oil and gas production in the Permian Basin is still projected to grow substantially to become one of the world's largest sources of climate pollution. The Permian Basin is exploited using horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing, also known as fracking, a method that requires intensive drilling and massive quantities of water, sand, and toxic chemicals. oil production in the basin grows, so does the production of methane gas and gas liquids, a mixture of ethane, propane, butane, isobutane, and pentane. These are the toxic and climate-potent byproducts of the basin's oil boom that impact people's health and their lives. The scale of the basin's potential to produce this wide range of hydrocarbons not only marks the basin as a carbon hotspot, but as a major source of plastics, one of the world's other 21st century environmental crises. Spread over a mostly remote area the size of Kansas or Britain, drilling in the basin is barely regulated. Tens of thousands of wells have been drilled and fracked in the past decade, covering an area of nearly 6,000 square miles or 15,000 square kilometers. The drilling frenzy has led to waste on a massive scale. Methane gas, which accelerates climate change at over 80 times the rate of carbon dioxide, is vented and flared at unprecedented rates. A recent study estimated that a stunning 3.7% of gas produced in the Permian Basin is venting into the atmosphere. This places Permian Basin oil and gas among some of the most climate polluting in the world. It multiplies the climate impact of the basin's production, creating a toxic legacy in a vast mountain desert landscape with extraordinary biodiversity. Basin scale and unregulated growth has overwhelmed the U.S. markets for its products. Most of its oil and gas is exported to global markets. To facilitate its growth, a massive build-out of gas processing plants, pipelines, export terminals, and petrochemical complexes has emerged, creating a network of industrial pollution from southeast New Mexico to the Gulf Coast of Texas. This has intensified existing environmental injustice and racism across this vast region and is spreading it to areas yet to experience it. As the world deals with the COVID-19 crisis, it faces an even bigger challenge to build a fairer, healthier, and more sustainable and resilient economy. This puts the Permian Basin and Gulf Coast at a crossroads. We can either manage a phase-out of the toxic reliance on hydrocarbon production and processing, one that supports workers and communities through this difficult but necessary transition, or we can have communities continue to experience pollution, environmental injustice, fear and boom and bust cycles, along with the inevitable and devastating reality that climate change will surely bring. Throughout this website, we track the Permian Basin's oil and gas developments, impacts, and possible futures. We explore the climate impact of the Permian boom, the public health, environmental, economic, and social impacts of fracking, the Permian Basin's link to environmental injustice and petrochemical expansion on the Gulf Coast, and the flow of Permian hydrocarbons to export markets. We highlight the development of expansion-enabling infrastructure such as pipelines and export terminals, and we lift up the people confronting the assault this infrastructure places upon communities. the climate impacts, the exports and infrastructure, the petrochemical expansion, the lack of regulations, and the impacts on frontline communities in this region are in themselves strong enough reasons to stop extraction in the Permian. Together, they form something even more terrifying. This is the Permian climate bomb.
Next, we listen as the CEO of Australia's The Climate Council, Amanda McKenzie, introduces a webinar about seizing the decade. You'll find a link in the show notes that will take you to that report.
So just to firstly say welcome, thank you for joining us. I think it will be a really exciting webinar tonight, and we're going to be stepping through this new report that we're very proud of, Seize the Decade, which is a practical plan, and it spells out how we're going to cut pollution by 75% this decade. We have, as you know, put out lots of reports about how, about why that target is absolutely critical, but this is about the plan to get there. So if you don't know me, I'm Amanda McKenzie. I'm the CEO of the Climate Council. And so before we get started, I wanted to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land that we're meeting on. For me, that's the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. And I pay my respects to elders past, present and emerging. Acknowledge any Indigenous people on the call today. And acknowledge that the leaders, First Nations leaders here and around the world have been absolutely at the forefront of the climate crisis. In their leadership has been critical in many different facets, and acknowledge that leadership and how important it would be, it has been, and ask you to share where you are from in the chat so we get a sense of where everyone is joining from. So as you may know, in my role, I speak to a lot of different people about climate change, and one question always comes up: is it really possible to slash climate pollution as fast as we need to avoid the worst impacts of the climate crisis? And if so, how do we do it? So you'll be relieved to hear that we know how to do it. And we have now done that research in a lot of detail. We've spent the last year doing a very detailed analysis, as well as a range of different research pieces to allow us to get a view of the whole of the economy, how we can slash climate pollution, provide a macro roadmap of how to do that across the economy, as well as a detailed policy gallery for decision makers at state, federal, local levels to then implement that roadmap. So the plan's called Seize the Decade. You might have seen it in the media, in emails from us, and we really encourage you to download the report, have a look at it. But ultimately, it shows how Australia can cut pollution three times faster than what the federal government is now proposing and is underway in doing. So one thing that's a really important thing to take away, if you take away nothing else from tonight, it's that there has been a big turnaround in Australia in the last 2 years. The federal government has been introducing a range of different pieces of legislation and funding that is transforming the Australian economy. And that builds on work from state governments, from local governments, business and households. It means that Australia is now powered 40% from renewable energy. We have 3.5 million homes with solar panels. So we are actually on this journey together. We're not at the starting blocks, we're firmly down the pathway. And what is required now is to absolutely increase the pace and the scale of what we have already been doing. This is about expanding our energy system, powering it with renewable power, and doing a whole range of other things across each of our sectors, proven solutions that are already available to slash pollution. So the message is that this is a great opportunity for us to protect our kids, their future, but it's also about providing the opportunities for the Australian economy into the future that leads to jobs and industries that allow communities to thrive in an ongoing way.
And coming up in May will be the Consumer Energy Summit, organised by Australia's Smart Energy Council. The event will be held on Thursday, May 30, from 8:30 in the morning till 4 o'clock in the afternoon. It says consumer energy has garnered significant government attention, with both federal and state authorities investing substantially in this sector, encompassing home batteries, virtual power plants, demand response applications, home energy generation, and smart vehicle charging. This summit represents a pivotal platform within the energy market. The Smart Energy Council says the program will include discussions on small-scale energy storage, particularly residential energy storage systems, addressing forthcoming industry changes. It says, with natural government emphasis on consumer energy resources, new governance, markets and policy directions are imminent for consumer energy across Australia. You'll find a link for that website in the show notes. Now we have the opening segment from Volts, the podcast, and this episode is Fashion's Climate Impact and How to Reduce It. You'll find a link for that episode in the show notes.
Hello, everyone. This is Volts for April 12th, 2024. Fashion's Climate Impact and How to Reduce It. I'm your host, David Roberts. As anyone who knows me or has ever even seen a picture of me knows very well, fashion is not at the top of my priority list. I wear basically the same thing every day and attempt to think about clothing as little as humanly possible. However, the fashion industry has a larger carbon footprint than you probably think, and it is growing rapidly with the spread of so-called fast fashion. What's more, there has been little scrutiny of the industry. It is quite opaque about its impacts, and there have been relatively few efforts to change that state of affairs. So, like an anthropologist venturing into a mysterious foreign land, I am wandering into fashion to try to understand it better. My guide in this journey is Maxine Beda, a former fashion startup CEO who has pivoted to activism, founding a nonprofit called the New Standards Institute and backing legislation, the Fashion Act, in New York and other states. I am talking with Beda about the source of the fashion industry's emissions, what can be done to reduce them, the need for regulation, and the right way to think about fast fashion.
Now we have 90 seconds from Yale Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. During an extreme weather disaster, your home could suffer costly damage and your place of work could close for weeks or months. There's no way to make it easy, but you can take steps now to make your financial recovery smoother. Before extreme weather is in the forecast, make sure your insurance coverage is up to date. And take photos of the rooms in your house so you can more easily make claims for items that are damaged or destroyed. It's a good idea to print out information about bank accounts, bills, and loans so you can make payments and communicate with lenders. Store these records where you can access them quickly. If possible, sign up to have your paychecks directly deposited into your bank and enroll in automatic deposits for federal benefits. So if mail service is interrupted or you're displaced and can't check your mailbox, you can still get your money. Having some cash on hand is important if ATMs are not working or banks are closed. And if your finances allow it, maintain an emergency savings fund to provide a cushion if you lose work. Living through a disaster is bound to be disruptive, but preparing and organizing your finances can help make the recovery process a lot less stressful. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Coming up now is a story from EcoWatch. It's by Kristen Hemingway-Janes. It has the headline, "A Massive Win for All Generations. European Human Rights Court rules Switzerland violates rights with climate inaction." The story begins. In a historic ruling, the European Court of Human Rights has found that Switzerland's inadequate efforts to tackle climate change violated the human rights of its country's citizens, represented by more than 2,000 older Swiss women. The landmark decision sets a powerful precedent for future climate-related lawsuits in Europe and around the world. Yes, we've reached the end of this episode of Climate Conversations. Thanks so much for your company. It's been great to have you along. Now, my screen is still alive with stories about the climate crisis, so I'll put as many links as I can in the show notes. So please go there, check them out, think about it, and make some decisions how you will respond. Now, I'd love you to follow this podcast, because if you do that, you'll be alerted every time I publish a new episode. Also, I'd love to have your voice on this podcast, so please contact me via email at r.mclean7@icloud.com, and I'll contact you either by phone or via Zoom. Also, I'd love to know what you think about this podcast, so please tell me, don't hold back, good or bad, please let me know. Same email address, don't be afraid. Now, please share this. Yes, put it on your networks. Let your friends know what's going on with the climate crisis. It's important, because to change everything, we need everyone. Now, until we talk again, please take care, stay safe, and please be kind. For everyone you meet is fighting a great battle. Now, take care and stay safe.